Author of the Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
Vidisha, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you very much.
We are here talking about your fifth book, Asylum in Exile. Tell us about Asylum in Exile.
Asylum in Exile grew out of several months of outreach work that I did with asylum seekers and refugees in London a few years ago now, but I've been doing it since. And I met these people in underheated, underfunded charity rooms in London, and they struck me as being the most interesting, intelligent, funny individuals I'd ever met. And it bothered me that I would do these outreach sessions and then open up a tabloid or a broadsheet newspaper and see cliches and stereotypes about asylum seekers and refugees, either very vilifying stereotypes like, here are all these people and they're criminals and liars and they're here to take from the country, or very patronizing stories about people dying in boats trying to reach England or France or Australia or Italy.
Yeah, and we do prefer them dead.
Yeah, and without names and faces. So even if you're talking to someone who's very sympathetic and they'll say, did you see that terrible report about all those people drowning in the middle of the sea? And you'd say something like, yeah, I did see it. What were their names?
Mm-hmm.
And no one can tell you because they're not remembered. And it bothered me that there was a sort of gap that mm-hmm. no one was telling these stories.
One of the things that I just, in terms of reading it, realized, I didn't know the difference between an asylum seeker and a refugee. And an asylum seeker is a person in the 1951 Act of Refugees is applying for refuge in the UK. And a refugee is a person who has been accepted as having...
That's exactly it. So you turn up, in many cases, with absolutely nothing. You turn up at an airport and you say, I am applying for asylum. And that could be political asylum, where you've been politically persecuted, or it could be other types of asylum. And as an asylum seeker, so someone who's waiting to get their case heard by the Home Office, you are in this completely new country, new society, maybe usually a new language as well. And you have no right to anything, so no right to public money, housing, education, shelter, food, absolutely nothing. If finally your case is heard by the Home Office and they accept that you are a legitimate asylum seeker, you gain refugee status, but even that doesn't grant you very much. It's only the first step in a very long process to legitimization, and what virtually all of the people I worked with said was that there was an absolute culture of disbelief and denial at the Home Office.
Mm.
They would have to go in front of these panels and talk about things that they'd survived, which might be something as simple as abject poverty or war, a fragile state, terrible political persecution, sexual violence, torture, witnessing these things, being threatened with these things. And the message that would come back would be something like, everything you've just said is a fairy tale you just made up. And that's a quote from a Home Office interview. And when the man who had been told that said it in the class, everyone else in the class chimed in because they'd all been told the same phrase. Everything you're saying is a fairy tale. I did an event with a guy called Bamidelli who had sought political asylum. And he said it got to the point where he had told his story so many times and been told you're lying that he himself began to disbelieve his own story. It's almost like brainwashing,
mm-hmm.
that you're told you're a liar, you're a liar, you're a liar. And this is a guy who had actually been a politician in Nigeria and had lots of proof that he was under threat. And he had scars, physical scars, to prove it. And they still said that you're a liar. So I think it's not just a culture of disbelief. I think that the officials, the government in this country, have been told to deny people.
Yep.
They may well believe them, actually. And I don't think they're awful people who genuinely don't believe. I think they've been told to say no.
Because it's politically unpopular.
It's politically unpopular, and there's also no money in it.
Mm.
And this is an austerity time. So I think that when you accept someone as a refugee, you're offering to protect them, shelter them, to provide for them in the most meagre way, and the government would rather spend money buying and selling weapons or leasing out beautiful tower block penthouse apartments to very rich residents than to just give out money.
Yeah, so they don't want anyone coming here who cannot support themselves for, regardless of the humanitarian concerns.
That's exactly the argument, and we're shocked because, of course, we see things in a humanitarian light, and it always bothers me how cruel people in these systems and governments and institutions are. They don't care about that. They don't see someone in front of them who's been threatened with torture. They just see a problem that they don't even want to solve the problem. They want it to go away. They want to turn people away. And that's why so many of the people I worked with were just bounced between prison and detention centres. I do a lot of work in prisons too, and I can say that detention centres are more frightening. If you're in detention, you have no rights. A prisoner has rights, right to legal representation, right to make a phone call. Detainees don't. And there are more rolls of barbed wire outside Dover Detention Centre than there are outside Holloway Prison. This place is designed to make you completely lose heart. So it's terrifying, and it's completely unseen, because these are people who've got no power. They're not famous journalists. They're not like you or me who've got a public platform. And so there's nothing to counter the narrative that is the main story, which is really negative. And nobody on the left, in the mainstream left, has stood up to counter that narrative, because, again, there's no money in it.
Yeah.
There's no votes in it. Everyone is so ignorant that it would take Ed Miliband 5 years to sit in front of people and set out, look, you know, there aren't that many migrants and immigrants in this country. England isn't full. The benefit system is not clogged up with foreign people taking from this country. All of those myths aren't true. And because no one really wants to listen. I think there's a fear of change and a fear of otherness, but it bothers me. I feel like England is moving towards insularity. In a really dangerous way. I mean, I'm second generation British Indian myself. My mum's a scientist. She came over in 1972 because England was desperate for scientists. It didn't have the brain power itself, you know? And to see the narrative turn around so quickly in my own lifetime really frightens me.
My weekday fix? Darling, it has to be Radio Gorgeous.
But tell me about, you were teaching, you were doing sort of writing workshops with two groups of asylum seekers and refugees. Tell us about the two different groups.
So I was at one place, which is for asylum seekers and refugees and undocumented people who might simply turn up with nothing, having been referred there by a border agency. And that was in East London in Bethnal Green, in quite a frightening building, really. It was a fantastic organisation called Praxis that deals with, you know, thousands upon thousands of people every year in an area which on the one hand is really coming up. So Bethnal Green has lots of beautiful old houses and hipsters and people spending money, and then you've got extreme inequality and poverty. And the second group was the Migrants Resource Centre in Victoria. It was very interesting because in the Bethnal Green Centre you had people who had come with nothing. So the people I worked with had really, they'd taken a bus for 3 hours to get in. They were relying on their expenses being reimbursed, and these expenses were just, you know, £6, absolutely nothing. They were surviving on a few pounds a day, which is very, very hard to survive on. It's almost impossible. The Migrants Resource Centre really explained the different types of migrants you can get. So I had Italian architects, I had a French woman who had a PhD in psychology. These were knowledge workers, migrants who were very well resourced, very highly educated, who were on their feet and who were oftentimes moving within the EU. So if you're an architect from Milan, it's really no big struggle to come to London and try and get some work.
These were migrants with status.
Migrants with status and networks who were not politically persecuted. We had two beautiful, wonderful Iranian girls who were sisters, and we were all, the entire group was very loving towards them because they were clever and beautiful and charming, and we loved them. And one was a classical Persian dancer, and the other one was a computer engineer. And I actually got my mother, who's a computer scientist, to try and get her just a bit of hourly work. And yes, they are fleeing an extremely repressive regime, but they clearly also had money of their own. And they were not asylum seekers, and they were not refugees in the sense that my East London group were. There was a real difference of status, and it was visible. I realised also that you can't tell anything about the way about what someone's like from how they look, but you can sometimes tell levels of monetization. So I would look at my group in Bethnal Green and think, oh my God, you know, they're wearing these inexpensive clothes that aren't going to keep out the winter chill. And so sometimes the poverty was visible.
Mm.
And doing these outreach sessions sharpened my eyes to that, because I think what happens is we live our daily lives and we don't see people. And suddenly you realise that the person that you're not noticing in the crowd is probably one that has the most interesting story to tell and that you could learn the most from. So I didn't learn very much from all of my wonderful Zhuzhi international folk from Victoria, even though they were much more sort of class appropriate for me. So we all rubbed along together and it was very, very entitled. I learned the most from the people who were the most unlike me.
Well, it occurs to me that one of the ways to educate us out of our stereotypes and out of our fear of asylum seekers and refugees would be that these people are incredible survivors, that they have survived whatever has already happened in their country, that they have emotionally survived enough to propel themselves with difficulty to even get here. And then what they do to just survive around on a daily basis during this process. These are incredibly tough, resourceful people who are valuable.
I think that you are completely and utterly, absolutely right. And yet what happens is when you turn up in a country seeking asylum, nobody asks, nobody thinks to ask what you've escaped or to dwell on the points that you have made, which is that these are very, very strong people who are actually incredibly optimistic. So the great thing about doing these sessions was they didn't want to talk about what they'd survived. I mean, it would leak out because we gained trust and we were talking amongst ourselves all the time, but they live through life every single day moving from one thing to the next, and they say to themselves, well, if I get through today and tomorrow, then that's a good thing and I'm just going to chop along. And so towards the end of our sessions, one of my favourite students was suddenly saying that she couldn't turn up because she had got a job at the Holiday Inn as a support worker, maybe a cleaner, maybe a chambermaid, but that's not the point. She had got it and they were doing a training session and they were moving on. And there was this wonderful ability to survive and to look ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come back and you look at the TV where the cabinet are talking about these issues in a horrible, ignorant way. And you look at these posh white men who went to the best schools in the country, and even, you know, even the Milibands are rich, I'm sorry, but you know, there's not a huge amount of difference between left and right in terms of basic privilege. They have never struggled with anything in their lives, and they have the glow of people who are having three square meals a day. And believe me, you can tell if someone's got shiny hair and plump cheeks, they're doing fine, absolutely fine, because I could tell from my students that that wasn't always the case.
And you have dedicated the book to one of your students.
Beatrice.
Yes. Beatrice Tibahurira?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly so right.
It's
well
to Beatrice and features a lot of her work. So in an incredibly concrete way, you have given her a voice.
Yeah, but I need to give her some money. I haven't yet been paid anything for this series, but I will make, as soon as I get some money out of the back of this, I'm going to start making proper donations to practice because, but I mean, scarily enough, these charities are sorely underfunded, and thanks to the austerity measures, all of these kinds of charities have just been shot in the back of the knees, basically. But Beatrice was one of my students who truly also wanted to be a writer. I mean, everyone turned up because we were enjoying ourselves, but she was the one who, she came in the first day and she had a book in her hand. It was a library book. I think it was an autobiography of a woman, a Middle Eastern woman, because it had a beautiful woman on the front cover. And she said to me, you know, my pen is like an extension of my hand. If my pen's not in my hand, I feel like I don't have a hand. And she came up to me after the first or second session with all of these pages, handwritten, and she'd made copies of them by hand. And she said, I'm writing a long letter to my son to explain the story of my life, to explain to my children, because she was 56 or so. She'd left behind 5 children in Uganda. She said, I want to explain why I left. Whether they forgive me or not forgive me, it's not for them to say. I have to explain why. And her writing was just incredible. And I had to get people to read it in some way. And I didn't want to just mark it and give it back to her, because I knew that publishing is hard. There's a small likelihood of her ever becoming a published writer in her own right. But she's the one person whose name I didn't hide or change. I'm pretty sure the police aren't going to come for her. I think she's secure. And she was just such a wonderful writer. So funny and so precise and thoughtful and an amazing woman. The kind of, you know, you wouldn't notice her in a crowd, and yet she had so much charisma that when she spoke in the class, everyone else would fall silent without realizing it.
Wow.
And that was that's the power of charisma, isn't it? Because it's nothing to do with how you look. It's a sort of inner quality.
Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah.
The ages in the class ranged from late teens to 60s.
Yeah. So I can't remember the real names of some of my students because they're so real to me as characters. Elodie was about 19, mm-hmm. and she spoke French and about 2 other languages and was learning English, and she's now got a job showing people around the Wallace collection. And she was hilarious because she was applying for this job while I was teaching her, and it's a cultural job, you know, it's a very fine collection of paintings. And she said, okay, culture, so is that like an Eddie Murphy film? And I was like, oh God, you're crazy. And she said, I think I've been to the Barbican once. And I went, God, okay, you know what, you need to go online, look at some paintings. And she got the job. Oh. And just the sheer ability to survive, that sheer ability to apply for a job and get on with it. Mm-hmm. In a culture which is going to look down on you and look at her and make all sorts of judgments about who she is. I just thought it was so amazing and impressive. And all my students were like that. They were just full of life and full of beans. The one difference was that some of the older students suffered not from loss of confidence exactly, but there's a sort of weariness that had set in. And there were a couple of quite fragile students, and I felt that they had some kind of long-range PTSD, some sort of trauma, because so many of my students had aches and pains and headaches and these sort of chronic but low-level physical reactions which never get treated. I mean, being counseled for PTSD, to me, that's a middle-class thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the first thing on your mind when you're homeless and you have no money, but trauma leaks out physically somehow, I think.
Yes. Can I ask you to read?
Oh my gosh, yes.
It's you were writing letters.
Yes.
And this letter
just kills
very
you,
short.
Doesn't it?
It kills you. It's very short, but it does. This is the level of decimation in people's lives. And if you would.
So Gloriana Paston was this wonderful woman who was always laughing and joking and teasing everyone. And I discovered this in the back of her exercise book. And she didn't tell me she'd written it. I found it later. So we're writing letters, and she wrote, "Dear daughter, I'm writing this letter to tell you exactly what happened between me and your dad. It was during the war in our country. And by then you were a toddler, so you can't remember anything. I was raped by the rebels and was trying to hide it from your dad. I don't know how he came to know about it, but since then, he don't want me any more in his life. My dear daughter, can you please talk to your dad so that he can take me back home?" And, you know, it just killed me because, again, you can't tell anything about what someone has gone through just by looking at them. I thought that she was this marvelous woman, yeah, always smiling, and yet what happened to her is what happens to so many rape survivors. There were many stories of rape.
That's what I wanted to ask you. It seemed to me that there was a disproportionate amount of victims of sexual violence, and that litany seems to continue for them as well in sort of the vulnerable places that they're then placed.
You're absolutely right. As we know, as women, sexual violence, we should call it male sexual violence against women and girls, which is what it is totally endemic. And it's also particularly endemic in wartime. And yet what these women asylum seekers come up against is rape culture times 10. So it's denial and disbelief, but also the terrible stigma of being a survivor. So time and again, the women I worked with wouldn't tell me outright that they had survived sexual violence. I would find out through conversation or through finding scraps of paper in the back of the exercise book or anonymous pieces of writing. They didn't talk about it amongst themselves, and they didn't talk about it in front of men. I doubt very much that they would want to talk about it in front of a panel of Home Office officials, regardless of whether they were women or men officials. Mm-hmm. It's not the kind of thing you talk about. I mean, even amongst our own friends.
But it literally rendered her homeless and stateless.
Yes. So what you see is that survivors of sexual violence are themselves stigmatized in their own lives and communities. They are rejected by their friends and their families. It's a sort of double dose of misogyny.
And then you come here and seeking and beseeching for asylum, but it's like rape isn't a good enough reason.
Yeah, it's not a good enough reason. You're not believed. I think there's a view that, oh, you know, women will say anything to get asylum. And I think that is also a belief which is held even amongst British survivors of sexual violence, that we're just lying. It's not true. It's some, you know, we've made a mistake. On top of that, I'm not even sure how many women asylum seekers would say that they have survived sexual violence. Mm. But a huge report was done on this by the amazing charity Women for Refugee Women, which was started up by the writer Natasha Walter. And they discovered that it's really around a half of all the women who were claiming asylum had survived sexual violence from someone. And the shocking thing is that sometimes, yes, it was the rebels and the militia, sometimes it was the government, sometimes it was their husband or the uncle or all of the other things that happened. And their research showed that by and large they were completely disbelieved, not only at home, but also in the country where they'd sought asylum. And that this disbelief had really serious consequences because you're disbelieved and then you're application is rejected, and in many cases you are made completely destitute because you've got no recourse to public funds or housing or anything like that.
So,
and then of course there's a very high risk of being sexually exploited. If you're destitute, a man offers you shelter, he seems kind, and then within 5 days either you are raped or you are sexually exploited in a psychological way, so you feel that you must yield sexual labour, you know, make yourself available. Or you're on the streets and you're simply raped by someone on the street, or you're forced into prostituting yourself. So everything you can imagine as a woman in your worst fears is true, which makes me sad.
Yeah.
But at least we're looking at the reality of it.
Yeah.
Listen to us online, on your phone, download a podcast, or on your tablet. Radio Gorgeous, there for you.
Badisha, amazing. but I want to talk about you a bit, because you burst onto the literary scene with your first book, Seahorses. But I was interested when you wrote about Venice, because...
Wonderful Venice.
In relationship to this, was it the first time in your life you didn't know the language and you were sort of a displaced, you know, didn't know the mores, didn't know the...
true.
Yeah.
I miss Venice all the time. Yeah. And in fact, whenever it rains and there's that sort of stony smell, I really miss Venice a lot. So I went to Venice in 2004 and lived there for a few months and went back and forth for about a year because my best friend lived there, and she'd concealed from me the fact that she and her family lived in this amazing palazzo on the Canal Grande and were enormously rich, because I met her as a student in London when she was just living in Hampstead, just a room in central Hampstead. That should have told me. And I went over there, and it was beautiful and wonderful and a very interesting city. And because I knew a very old family, I could get in a way that no other travel writer could. And I discovered that it's sort of like a Jane Austen novel or a Henry James novel. You know, you have there's a thin veneer, there's a surface of social propriety. And you really need to know someone on the inside, otherwise you will never penetrate the secret of what Venice is. But it was also interesting discovering a new culture, because you're always on the back foot. Even if, like me, you were, I spoke French and Spanish to some degree, and so Italian isn't hard to learn. But I'm a different colour. I didn't realise that northern Italy... Italians do have a colonial history in northeast coastal Africa, but they're not seen as a very strong colonial power. So there's not that understanding of who these brown people are. And they hate Arabs. And if you're brown, they think you're an Arab, which I'm not. Or they think you're Muslim, which I'm not. But there's a real sense of xenophobia. And it comes out quite strongly. So in the summer when everyone was tanned, everyone thought I was Italian anyway. That was fine. And then in winter, like, all my friends' tans would fade. And they'd go back to their sort of beautiful creamy colour. And I would be given such short shrift in shops. It was hilarious. I remember walking in and saying, do you have a phone card? And the guy just went, no. And I had to back out of there. But he said no, and he gave me that really hard look where they want you to feel the insult, and then they stare you out until you literally back away. I didn't even turn my back. I sort of took steps backwards. And it was a lot like that. And I witnessed so much racism. On my first trip, I saw the officials at Venice Treviso Airport going down the line and just harassing every black British person who was in the queue. And I'm like, are you joking? They were, you know, these are Londoners who were looking at these Italian small-time officials with complete incredulity. And the officials were harassing them to open their bags and clicking their tongues at them. It was the most base, knee-jerk racism you could possibly witness. And yet at the same time, Venice is truly sophisticated and beautiful, and I like formal cultures. I like northern formal ceremonial cultures, because of course if you behave on the surface you can do what you like underneath. but it's very, very hard. Italian is this beautiful language. It's quite easy to learn, but the way of this kind of verbal back and forth which you need to do is difficult to learn. So the words aren't hard, but the mores are difficult. You're supposed to walk into a cafe and go, oh, the sunlight is so beautiful today. I was taking a walk by the coast. The sea was so lovely. Could I possibly ask you for a cappuccino? And then the person goes, ah, but madam, yes, of course, the sun is so bright at this time of day. Naturally, you're thirsty after your walk, and it's just the right time for a cappuccino. Here you are. It's extra hot and extra frothy for you. And you go back, and that's what you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to go, one cappuccino, please.
And that's which, a bit abrupt.
It's too abrupt. It's sort of very Englishy. And they also think that the English have sort of poles up their butts, which, I mean, I'm very critical of the English myself, because you always criticize the culture you know best. So it was quite hard getting in under the surface. But I retain my love for Italy, and I always will do.
What's next for you?
I am... Gosh, you're the first person I've said this to, so now I've got chills. I'm returning to fiction after 17 years, which is a huge thing and very frightening. I mean, I'm not scared of anything but this. I have no idea why. It should be simple, but I am in the process of getting together a collection of long, short fiction. I adore novellas. I'm passionate about that kind of form. You know, sort of 70 pages, like Death in Venice. Or a Daphne du Maurier novella, and I'm coming back after in 2017 with a collection of original long short fiction.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us, contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com, and to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?
Dalla genera ambaria. Allahu Akbar.